Excision number 11938, wheel 15.
Aston, reel 15.
I remember the battalion headquarters moved to a place called Ofcombe. Ofcombe is about half a mile east of the A38, midway between Taunton and Exeter. And it's central on the neck, the narrow neck of the West Country Peninsula, about 20 miles from the south coast and 20 miles from the North Devon coast in the Bristol Channel. B Company were 4 miles south at Trenhampton, and there were two companies at Wellington, about 10 miles north towards Taunton. And I think the other company must have been in Ofcombe with Headquarter Company. Most of Headquarter Company were billeted in a big house, quite a big house, on the south of the village. And the battalion headquarters were in two houses in the centre of the village, facing a village square, more or less. the MT section was in two or three garages and part of the garden, bothies and the potting sheds and things like that, because everything was unloaded here and stored away in buildings, and the transport was freed so that we could use the transport for other purposes. Still short of transport, even at this stage. But things were getting better, but the fitting shop was in the garages and the stores were in one of the, I think it was a bothy, belonged to the gardens of that big house. In front of the house, I remember a big field where we did a couple of parades, I think it was sort of two company parades. Now, with being central and behind the two coasts, there we became a mobile reserve. But we're still short of transport for the full job that we're supposed to do. So the training then did start in earnest, more or less, and we used whatever transport we could. And the equipment was coming through now, and certainly the carriers were into full swing again. I think the 3-inch mortars were on, had been replaced, and we were sort of getting more back to what a mobile unit should be. We did. One very big scheme I remember was going southwest of Exeter, quite a way, and then working our way back north across Dartmoor, past the prison, Princedown Prison. And we spent 3 nights on the moor, and we finished the exercise in Barnstaple. We had a night's sleep in a girls' school, the girls' high school. That was after about 5 days. That was all cold and chilly, as only Dartmoor can be, and wet and boggy. Then we were really getting some training in as a mobile unit again. I'd done it before, but now here, I don't know whether I mentioned it, but we did get another, we got another big draft of Scotchmen. Now, which one, I think it was the QSBs that came in at this particular time. And that was quite a big draft. And later on, during our stay at Ofcombe, which was only about a month, they took the older people away again, and the LOBs left out of battle. And these were people who were considered to be too old to be going to wherever we were going to go to.
Do you recall ever losing any men because of the skilled civilian employment that they had? Recall back into civilian life?
Very few. Very few. One or two miners did go back, but that was mainly because they had families, I think. Most of the miners, I think, were happier to be out in the army than they were back in the pits. In fact, I'll be saying later on about talking to two miners who became quartermaster sergeants. And while the battle was on at the back side of Gazala, we sat watching the battle and talking, and we had quite a long talk about mines and different things, and they were quite happy to be doing something different, because the quartermaster sergeant, they were pretty well paid for that, for those days. I mean, miners in those days, they weren't well paid. They were paid, and they had a few perks, like a cottage, but it was a tied cottage. If you fell out with a boss, you lost your cottage as well. It wasn't a particularly happy time for miners. And I do have some sympathy with them, but later on in life, they've rather overplayed it. But that's getting away from the point again.
When you were on exercises such as this, which lasted over several days, what kind of activities were you doing?
Well, at this stage, I'd started becoming the Ray Gun Charlie, picking up the strays that, as they happened, you know, if any vehicle broke down. The thing was that he pulled into the side of the road if it was possible, and he put a flag up to say that he was stopped and to go past. I think he put a green flag up. I can't just remember the codes now. I think we started with a blue one at the front, which was like a warning, and a green one at the back to say that I'm in convoy and overtake me. If a man broke down, he stopped, pulled into the side road and put the flag up, and vehicles knew that they had to go past him and carry on with it. And then we would pick him up. If he couldn't do it himself, we would pick him up at the end of the convoy. Now, when we were going up to Iraq, there was one stage I was 3 days behind the convoy. Fortunately, in Iraq, there was a good pipeline to follow us. It didn't matter too much, but it did happen again on the desert, where I was a day and a half behind the convoy, which wasn't very pleasant, because we were heading into a battle then. But
So you were at the rear of the convoy, picking up those that broke down, and presumably you had spares and items with you.
We carry much spare. In fact, when we were really on the thing, we carried all the spares that we had. Oil, water, fan belts, points, plugs, everything. And we only had a 3-tonner, you know. It was we were a bit restricted, especially when it came to springs and things like that.
Was there any particular fault which seemed to be recurring more often than any of the others on this kind of routine duty?
Well, one thing kept cropping up, and I don't know why, because petrol was pretty good in this country, but every now and again you got water. We often used to think it was deliberate, because it's a sure way of stopping a vehicle to put a good drop of water in the bottom, because that the petrol goes to the top of the tank and the water goes through into the carburetor and stops everything. There were occasions when we wondered if it was deliberate or not, because petrol was coming from pumps in those days, and there shouldn't have been water in the petrol unless it wasn't being refined properly. But the water was quite a problem, and a messy problem as well, because it might get underneath the drain, the water out of the tank, and then following the pipeline along, blowing all the pipes out, clean the pump out, clean the carburetor out. It's quite a slow, messy job. Points, they used to, the ignition points, that was a bit of a sore point. And then every now and again the fan belt, which shouldn't really have happened because they were inspected fairly regular, but it did. But that wasn't too big a problem, that. We carried a fair stock of fan belts.
You say that your vehicles were inspected fairly regularly? Were they inspected before and after you had worked on them? Or were they, and were they also inspected?
Well, we were doing inspections. We were inspecting them as we went along, as we were repairing, we were inspecting as well. And then the driver was supposed to do his checks. He had a list. He didn't have a book at this particular time, I don't think. All the carriers had books. They had books all the way through, where they had to do a check every time they went out, and there was a list of vehicles, similar to what the air pilot does today. There's a list of things he had to check before he set off. And again, when he pulled up at night, or lathered up at night, he had a certain number of checks to carry out, like the depth of slack on the track. Generally, if your hand went in like 4 inches, if you had 4 inches of slack, it was too much. So you had to adjust the track and tighten it up, which wasn't an easy job on some of them, but most of them was a simple job, but it wasn't too easy, especially if they were all muddy. And there wasn't always a hose pipe that you could clean them out with. And to try and clean them out with a spade, if it's tacky mud like you got on Dartmoor, it wasn't an easy job. So generally they used to try and find a stream and drive through the stream a little bit and get a lot of the mud off there. And then the farmer would complain that we made a muck of his water for his cows. But that was a general thing. We'd try and get them into a stream.
And lorry drivers had the same kind of...
Yes, but I don't think they had the books. The books did come along later, but I don't think at this stage that we actually had the 412, I think it was called AB412. And that again had the list in, and he had to put his ticks in where he'd checked it and the time he'd done it and so forth.
Was it an offence not to carry out these checks? Or to deliberately miss them?
Well, if they broke down, the first thing he did was fill the book in, wouldn't he? So, yes, if it could be proved that the thing hadn't been done, yes, it was an offence. And this is where Lockhart came into his own, that he could be a bit of a sod when he... Lockhart was the MTO, Motor Transport Officer. He could be a bit of a sod if he found out the things. Quite right. I mean, there's no sympathy with people, really, when you know that there's a possibility that it could be a life or a few lives at stake. Later on, when you got into battle, there could be a few lives at stake just because one person hadn't done one particular check.
What was the convoy discipline in England at this time? It would be obviously different from France.
No. Daytime was the same, and as I explained in a couple of tapes ago, that we drove on the diff light at night. But yes, the convoy discipline was the same, and that was one of the problems with going down to Dartmoor, where you got tracks crossing Dartmoor that could lead anywhere. I mean, the Dartmoor ponies used to make most of these tracks, and they would wander around anywhere they could find a decent bite, so you were following them round in circles in sometimes. But the officers, the navigators, they were supposed to take us in a pretty straight line across these, the moor. But then, of course, having said that you go in a straight line, the straight line could easily lead you straight into a bog. And, of course, this happened later on the desert, because if you took a straight line, you very often finished up in a salt flat or a sand sea, which could be quite distressing. So it wasn't just as simple as taking a compass bearing and going on it. What you had to do was finish up on the compass bearing. And that is where the desert, we had sun compasses, which had a disc with the hours marked on it, and you move the disc around every hour so that it gave you the directions at that particular time. But on Dartmoor, you see, you had to go by the pony tracks, in a sense, because the ponies knew where they were going better than we did. So you had to get your direction and try and get there on the tracks or find a track that's going in that direction.
Were you much restricted again by the local communities to where you could drive and where you couldn't?
Well, the army had quite a lot of Dartmoor, a whole lot of Dartmoor. And generally, the civilians were sympathetic to us. I did mention that Paddy and I got into trouble for speeding when we were towing, which was dangerous when you think about it, because you got two vehicles with a tow rope in between. I mean, it was dangerous. But we were young and eager. So, yes, you did get the odd complaint, but generally speaking, they were very, very cooperative and good-minded. They thought quite a lot about us, in fact. No, we had much difficulty in that respect.
What kind of stages or stops did you make in a day's journey?
Now, that was... we tried to miss the villages if we could, in England. In France, we stopped wherever when the time appeared, you stopped. But in England, we tried to be agreeable to the people and sort of, we wouldn't stop across a farm gate or something like that. We're taught to try and be civil. It's a silly way to put it for an army man, but we're taught to try and be civil about when we stopped and when we didn't, and what we did when we stopped.
What was your role when the practice or the training reached a point where there was debussing and platoons and companies taking up positions and so forth? What was your role in this?
Well, in most cases, by the time we got there, the action had finished and they were ambushed on their way again. Not quite as bad as that, but if it was like that, you generally find some driver looking for us to say that you wanted this and that. It was mobile, but it wasn't just right. So you'd often find that a driver was looking for us. Oh, yeah.
How were the empty stores organised?
Well, normally we had a 3-ton truck full of stores with bins. A bin round the driver's end of the vehicle and along one side. And on the other side there was a bench with a vise and tools, awkward tools. Each fitter had his own little toolbox, and that was very sparse. But as we went on, we started collecting. We were buying our own, quite honestly, because it was saving us time, and it meant that we could do a better job. Occasionally, we would get some from a vehicle kit. If a vehicle was going back for some reason, and he'd had a toolkit with it, I'm afraid the toolkit didn't go back with the vehicle, it should have done. It was purloined and we used whatever we could get hold of in that way. The stores were looked after by the technical sergeant. I don't know who the technical sergeant was at this stage, but I think it was Dickie Kent. And he had a Lance Corporal Bailey, who did the actual issue of stores. And he made tickets out. We went in and said, who wants so-and-so for so-and-so, giving him the number of a vehicle, because all army vehicles are numbered, apart from being the registration number, they have an army number. And the stores were issued on that army number. And he would make a ticket out saying what we'd taken out and to which vehicle it had been fitted to. And occasionally we'd get somebody come round, very, very occasionally, I don't remember once. Somebody come round and check that vehicle had been fitted with this particular store. And then the chits were collated in the office, and the technical sergeant, Dickie Kent, would order a replacement. So you had an establishment of stores which you carried for the particular vehicles that you had on your strength. The difficulty was when you got a strange vehicle coming in and you didn't have any stores for it, which did happen in occasions. Like I mentioned, that when we were in France, we had a guy, just one 1,500-weight guy, and stores for that were difficult because it meant that you were carrying stores for just one vehicle. Whereas if you had 20 vehicles, you could carry maybe five of one item. But if you've got one vehicle, you've got to carry one of each item. So it's difficult. And the technical sergeant, who was the highest paid in the MT rank, in the MT outfit, he had the job of making sure the stores were there and they could get one. I can remember once in Iraq where Michael Lockhart, the MTO, decided that we'd make our own battery acid because with the vehicles coming from the desert, we took over the 4th Indian Division's vehicles, and with the hot, the acid had evaporated. It shouldn't do. It should only be the water that evaporates, but you do get a gas coming off, which means that the acid is going as well. And in Iraq, we couldn't get any, so we had to make our own, and we split bottles up and put zinc in hydrochloric acid to make the battery acid. I stood for the right level, the right buoyancy, what's the term for it, I can't remember now. Like the alcohol level, how it stood for the right level, I don't know. But anyway, we made it and we survived. We kept going with this because in Iraq, you think of Iraq as a very hot country, which it is. But in winter, in 6 feet of snow and very, very cold. Just like off the steppes of Russia, it's very, very cold. So we had to make our own, you know, and these sort of things had to go on all the time. And I'll be saying about things on the desert later on. Well, we purloined any vehicle we could get hold of. We just went round and stripped it if it was out on the blue.
The technical sergeant, he would order stores in. Was that part of it?
From ordnance. From
where ordnance. Did they come? They came from?
Ordnance, from an ordnance depot.
And that would be within the area of the command?
Brigade had what is known as an LAD, a light air detachment. And they carried a certain amount of stores, empty stores. The ordnance department of that LAD carried a certain amount of stores. And then they again went back to a field park, a division, an ordnance field park, which is quite a big outfit and carried a lot of stores. So they came, we would use it on a vehicle. The technical sergeant ordered it from LAD. If LAD couldn't supply, it went back to the field park, which is division. And from there it went back to Corps, and from Corps it went back to the Army, until you got back to the factory and that was making it, more or less. So it went right through the chain. But the immediate stuff came from LAD.
Was there any situation where you wanted a part which had to go all back through the chain? If that was the case, how long was it likely to take to get back to you?
Well, depending where you were. In Iraq, it could be weeks. That's why we had to make our own acid. And on the desert, I mean, there just weren't any spares. So very often you'd go out and pinch a bit of a German tank and try and accommodate to do the job that you wanted to do. Tanks that are having to get left in the field because they took a lot of shifting. Again, when we get further on, I'll be describing how we brought a tank in one night.
So the stores, the storeman was in effect the technical sergeant.
Yes.
He was in control.
Yes, we had they were tradesmen. There was a technical sergeant, and as I said, he was the highest paid man in the MT section. And he had a lance corporal who actually dished the stores out, and he was a tradesman. He was pretty well paid as well. And then there was a fitter sergeant who was quite, he was a tradesman. And he had a corporal, I'm talking now of the days in France. In France, we had a sergeant and a corporal and maybe four fitters. Then Remy came along and was formed, and then it was a Remy sergeant and a Remy corporal. And the highest rank that the battalion fitter could get then was a corporal. But with our fitter sergeant, being a sergeant all the time, they couldn't very well demote him. So we had a fitter sergeant right up to, well, into the desert days. So, but we were fortunate, but it was One of these things I did say before, that it upset us quite a bit, that the Remy came along and sort of took our promotion away.
Whereas their tasks were basically to be in command of the team that actually did the fitting.
Yes. They were our bosses, in fact, the way it was laid out.
What was the role of the MTO, the Motor Transport Officer?
Well, he worked more or less, he had a difficult situation, really. He worked with the adjutant a lot, because the adjutant would tell him which companies were doing so-and-so and which companies were doing something else. Each company had its own little body of transport, which came under the MTO, but they had the company drivers. And then you had the MT section in headquarter company, which were the three-tonners and the Cooks trucks, which went out when we were on the move. The Cooks trucks went out to the companies and carried the Cooks and what rations they were taking with them. But the MTO also had a task for the quartermaster, going collecting the rations and from brigade, from the RSC depot brigade, and bringing them back in and anything that the quartermaster wanted. He came to the MTO for transport to get whatever he wanted. So he had a very difficult job to try and keep the things on the move, because he was limited with the amount of transport he had at any time. Even when it was fully established, he was still limited with what he could do with the battalion on the move.
Would he be expected to know at any time, if asked, what transport was available and where it was?
Yeah. Yes, and the MT sergeant at this time was Joe Gray. Anyway, Sergeant Gray. He had a corporal, and they had a list of all the transport in the battalion, and transport which was assigned to companies, which they hadn't lost control of, but they hadn't much control, if you know what I mean. They were still in charge of it, but it was responsible to the company. But they had all these lists and where each vehicle was going each day, and generally they posted a roster up, or tried to put a roster up the night before, of what was required and which where each vehicle was going to be attached to. If it would go to the QMs, it would have so-and-so with vehicle so-and-so, quartermaster stores at a certain time. And that's what was expected, and that's what generally they got. So there was the empty sergeant, who weren't tradesmen, they were only paid as infantry sergeants and corporals. I think it was a lance corporal as well, but I can't just remember one. I know Frankie Andy was a corporal at this particular time, and Sergeant Gray was a sergeant. And they provided the MTO with the information which he wanted to take to the CO, to the CO's conference. I mean, if there was a move on at all, there was generally a what was known as the CO's conference. And the MTO would have to take all this with him, and if somebody wanted an extra truck, he'd have to juggle his figures around until he provided it. Or if he couldn't, he'd have to tell the CO, well, I can't do that because I don't have a vehicle. Then probably the CO would tell him, well, you'll find one. And he wouldn't tell him where to take it from. He'd just say, well, you'll find one. He's got to have an extra vehicle. And it was MT's job then to take one off somebody and put it to wherever the CO wanted it to go.
The MTO's responsibilities, did they also include routing and mapping of routing?
If it was a brigade move, the brigade MTO would do the routing so that all the roads available to him were utilised. And if it was a battalion move, he would also, the MTO would have to check with Brigade MTO to make sure that the roads that we wanted were available, because another battalion might be doing the same thing in the same place. Just like on Dartmoor, you see, the three battalions were on the Dartmoor, and we wanted to get way past Exeter south and then work our way across Dartmoor from the south to the north and finish up where we finished up in Barnstable. Some people were round the North Devon coast. So, yes, the MTO had to liaise with brigade and also make his own routes and tell him what he would like to do with this. And the brigade would say, yes, that's all right. I would say, no, you can't do that because the 8th Battalion is going across the O-line. And we can't, he can't do things like that. We can't have a battalion crossing each other. They've got to run parallel as far as possible.
So presumably at a CO's conference, the MTO would also be able to tell the CO what routes were available.
Yes. Yes. In most cases, he would know from the adjutant that we were going to move from A to B. And he best he could and take it to brigade MTO and get sanctioned before the CO's conference. Didn't always work that way. I mean, very often it was just a telephone call to say that we're going so and so and so and so on. Is that all right?
Was Lockhart particularly efficient as an MTO?
Oh, I believe he was, yes.
Had he been trained, just, or was it just thrust?
It was TA trained and touched. He was thrust into it, TA trained, yeah. Well, I mean, he got quite a belting in France, so he...